Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, U.S. candidate Trump gives a blistering foreign policy address. A Paris attack suspect is hastily handed over by Belgian authorities. We'll explore some of the coolest developments in technology and a chat with our pop music expert about Prince.
His accomplishments are quite vast. When you talk about 39 albums and over 100 million record sales since he started when he was only 19.
It's right here on the Voice of America. New York businessman Donald Trump has given a fiery speech on foreign policy. We'll have more on that in just a moment, but for a little background, Trump, in his race for the Republican Party's presidential nomination, has had decisive victories in five state primary elections in Delaware, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Connecticut, and Rhode Island.
I just want to tell you, for the five states, I am so honored. This was, to me, our biggest night because it shows such diversity.
Trump told supporters the race against Ohio Governor John Kasich and Texas Senator Ted Cruz is over. On the Democratic side, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton solidified her lead over lone rival Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders with wins in four of the five states. She is already looking ahead to the general election campaign.
Let's go forward. Let's win the nomination. And in July, let's return as a unified party.
With reaction to Tuesday's balloting and Trump's remarks, here in the studio with us is senior national correspondent Jim Malone. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Well, let's start off with the easy one. What do you think after Tuesday's balloting?
Well, it's looking obviously increasingly likely that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will be facing off later this year in the general election campaign. Trump took a big step toward the Republican nomination on Tuesday with the five wins. Not only were they all across those states, but they were by wide margins. He's upping the ante, so to speak, on the margin of victory. And I think more than just accumulating delegates now, there's a general sense that's starting to seep in among Republicans, even those not excited about Trump as the nominee, that he's probably on a path that makes it virtually impossible to stop him. That being said, in less than a week's time, we go to Indiana for a primary, and that's Ted Cruz's best shot at least slowing Trump down if he can win there.
Trump today gave what was billed as a major foreign policy speech, but I caught some of it, and it was really fiery. He was right there. Share with us some of your thoughts about it.
Well, basically what I've been able to hear from it is that he talked about basing his foreign policy on American interest, America first, if you will. He was very critical of the current administration, not only President Barack Obama, but his former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, his likely general election opponent, assuming they both get the nominations. He called their foreign policy reckless and rudderless, and basically said he would do a remaking of U.S. foreign policy. He talked about targeting ISIL. He says he won't say when or where he will take care of ISIL, but it will be gone if he becomes president. Talked about rebuilding the military and talked about defeating terrorism in the Middle East and promoting stability. You know, how much detail is here, I think we'll wait to see what foreign policy experts think, because Trump has been criticized for not being detailed enough. This is obviously, though, yet another pivot for him toward the remaking of his image as a more serious, sober, and detailed person who has now a foreign policy plan of some kind.
And we have word of a, quote, major announcement from the Cruz camp later today, and we don't know what it is specifically, but what is this all about, all this mystery? What's going on?
I don't know. I mean, it's some people are speculating that he may be announcing a vice presidential running mate, and a lot of the focus there or speculation is on Carly Fiorina, who was a former contender in the Republican primaries
and
early
on.
And a woman. Yep. Look, Cruz, again, he's focused on Indiana. He needs a breakthrough there if he has any chance of stopping Trump. Both Cruz and Kasich want a contested Republican convention. That's not only their best hope, it's their only hope to derail Trump's nomination.
Okay, thank you, Jim. We always appreciate your insight.
Sure.
And joining us here at the anchor desk is our social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky, who has more on this story as it is unfolding. Andrew, what's going on tweet and Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff?
Well, lots of talk on social media about this speech from Donald Trump, his first real major foreign policy speech. As a lot of people are noting, really his first speech that he's used to a teleprompter. Usually he kind of speaks off the cuff. And so both sides, whether you agree with Trump or not, are saying you can really tell when Donald Trump is speaking from the teleprompter and when he goes off the cuff, because you can see it's very measured when he's speaking from the speech, and then he kind of launches off into a tirade about something and just starts going off and kind of riffing. So people on both sides can see that. Trump supporters saying he looks very Reagan-esque, and they're comparing him to President Ronald Reagan.
In what way?
They're saying that it's just a very forceful speech, comparing it to Reagan's speech in Berlin where he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
Right.
They're comparing it and saying this is really the kind of force that America needs to show as far as foreign policy. But his detractors are saying, well, he's pledging all this money for defense and he's saying all these things, not really backing it up with much. And also, where is that money going to come from? Is it going to come from the expense of schools or infrastructure or other things that we need to be spending money on?
Right.
The other thing that's trending involving Donald Trump today is hashtag woman card.
Yes,
this has become a big topic.
Between him and Hillary.
Yes, last night in her victory speech, Hillary Clinton said that Donald Trump has told her that she's playing the woman card. So she says, if that means I'm playing the card of, you know, equal pay and family leave and all these things, then deal me in. And Donald Trump later in the night said, well, if she were a man, she wouldn't have more than 5%. She's just using this woman card. Well, hashtag woman card has become a trending topic now. You see a lot of women taking pictures. They've drawn up little cards that say, deal me in, say, this is my woman card, and I'm playing my woman card.
I don't have a woman card yet.
You're going to make up a woman card, but there's a lot of, you know, controversy about that back and forth, especially now that it looks like these two are going to be the general election nominees.
It appears that way.
This might be the first real back and forth fight. Direct fight between those two, certainly on social media.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA reports that its exoplanet-finding Kepler spacecraft has recovered from a recent bout of problems and has resumed its mission of looking for extrasolar planets. On April 7th, while Kepler team members were making a scheduled contact with the spacecraft, they noticed that it was operating in emergency mode, its lowest operational level. Mission officials say that the spacecraft probably went into emergency mode about 36 hours prior to its discovery. According to NASA, mission operators have since put Kepler through a series of procedures to take it out of emergency mode and normalize its operations. Among those procedures included reloading Kepler's computer data and turning the spacecraft so that its telescope points to the center of the Milky Way. This orientation allows Kepler to continue making its observations and looking for planets beyond our own solar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Paris attack suspect Salah Abdeslam has been hastily handed over by Belgian authorities to French authorities. He is accused in the March 22nd attacks on the Brussels airport and metro station that left 32 people dead. Paris correspondent Lisa Bryant joins us on the line. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, Susan. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Nice to have you. This transfer of the suspect, it all seems rather sudden.
In some ways, it does seem rather sudden. But in fact, the Belgian prosecutors had said earlier that they would be handing Abdeslam over to French authorities and would only notify the media after this was the case. And I think that's essentially what happened. As per what they've been doing recently, they just essentially write a very short statement that they send out to the media, which I got as well, saying this is what happened and no further questions will be taken. That's just been par for course over the last few weeks.
Is he cooperating with authorities, telling them what he knows about those attacks?
It'll be interesting to see whether he does. His new French lawyer says he does want to talk, that he's a broken man and does, you know, want to say things to authorities. But, you know, this is what we heard earlier when Abdeslam was first captured in Belgium a month ago, right before the Brussels attacks. Essentially, the Belgium authorities or his lawyer said that he was cooperating with the Belgian authorities, and then he stopped cooperating, apparently was silent. He claims, or at least his lawyer claims, because the Paris prosecutor had basically blabbed to the press and said exactly what he'd been talking about. But it essentially makes people a little bit suspicious about what he's going to say and whether he's going to really be talking.
What do we know about this suspect so far?
Abdeslam seems to know quite a lot of the suspects, the key suspects in both the Brussels attacks, those were the attacks last month, as well as the Paris attacks, in which he's considered the last surviving main suspect in the attacks. His brother was also involved in those attacks. Those are the ones in November that killed about 130 people and wounded hundreds of others. His brother was among the suicide bombers who killed themselves. Others were either shot dead or blew themselves up. Abdeslam, however, has a role that's quite unclear. He's been considered probably the person dealing with the logistics. He may have had a role, was supposed to have blown himself up as well, because he apparently disposed of a suicide vest or a suicide belt that was found. But whether he was actually supposed to blow himself up or not is unclear. Clear, although he does say, apparently, according to reports, that he had second thoughts and decided not to do so. But some believe he may not have played that big a role. It's just very unclear about exactly what his role was in the Paris attacks. But he does know people who were both involved in the Paris attacks, including one of the ringleaders, as well as those who were involved in the Brussels attacks, including one man who was considered what they called the man in the hat, called Labrini, who was arrested and had been a childhood friend of Abdeslam's.
Where will he be held in France?
He's going to be held at a prison called Fleury-Mérogis, which is considered the largest prison in Europe. It's huge. It's outside Paris. All kinds of people have been held there. I mean, kind of quote-unquote celebrity prisoners, as well as other Islamists. And that is to the south of Brussels. And he's going to be held apparently in isolation, high security, and it's supposed to be provisional. A lot of people who are held at Fleury-Mérogis are just there until they go to court or after they've been charged after a trial, in which case they go elsewhere.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa, for your insight.
Thanks very much, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, the latest tech news and the many talents of Prince. Every week, blogger Kevin Enox opens the door to the latest technological advances in his Look Back at the Future on voanews.com. He spoke about his latest report with International Edition's Ira Melman.
I think the most fascinating thing is the London Institute of Digital Archaeology has taken pictures of the Triumphal Arch in Palmyra, Syria, which was destroyed by IS. They took those pictures, they entered it into a 3D printer, and in a few hours, they recreated this Triumphal Arch in the Trafalgar Square in London. And it's amazing because it's not just the arch the way it looked back in the day. It is the arch as it looked exactly before it was destroyed, with pits and cracks and some places worn away by sand and weather. It is literally, they say, indistinguishable from the original, except it's on a 1-3 scale.
Yeah, but that's what I was just going to ask. I mean, I can't see a printer turning out real size things, and that would be somewhat cumbersome, I would think, huh?
It would, but this stands pretty tall. It's many feet tall, and the idea is if we were to take those places back and get some technology into the region, we could recreate what these places looked like before they were destroyed.
Yeah. What else we got?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things that we got this week is Lockheed Martin, which is a aerospace company in the U.S., is creating a curriculum, a science curriculum, to get kids interested in STEM research, science, technology, mathematics, education. And they have created a school bus, literally a yellow school bus that you see every day on the streets of America, and put 3D screens on the windows of the school bus. Now, the idea is that kids walk in the school bus pulls away from the parking lot, and they can see outside just like in their normal school bus, and then suddenly those screens dim, and what they see in their windows is real-life virtual image of the plains of Mars.
Oh, wow.
And so for 2,000 miles as you go through this bus, you're looking out the window at the landscape of Mars, and it is fascinating to watch it. It's very cool.
It's a good thing, but it's a good thing if they don't show it to the windshield so the driver thinks he's on Mars as well.
Yeah. Right. We're assuming the driver is not seeing this.
Yeah, we would hope so. You got something about the Titanic?
Yes, the Titanic. There is a company, video developers of a video game called Titanic Honor and Glory, which is a clue game where you run around the Titanic as it's sinking to try to save yourself. But what they have done as a tease for this game is they have put on YouTube a 2-hour, 41-minute real-time animation of the Titanic as it sank. So if you have 2 hours and 41 minutes, you can literally watch it slowly settle, list back and forth, hear rushing water, some screams, and then it sinks, breaks apart, and it's chilling. It's chilling because it happens. It's a very inevitable process, and we know how the story ends. But still, it's disconcerting to watch it in real time.
A frightening binge watch, I guess, huh?
Yes.
You can follow Kevin Enochs and his Look Back at the Future on voanews.com. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Strokes are a common cause of disability. They happen when blood and vessels in the brain leaks out or blood flow is blocked. University of Oxford researchers are looking at the possibility that electrical stimulation could be a benefit to recovering stroke patients for reasons that are not yet fully understood.
What we think it does is just allow the brain cells to fire just a little bit more.
That's Dr. Charlotte Stagg at Oxford. She says that stroke patients who received electrical stimulations called transcranial direct current stimulation showed better improvements at manual tasks than those who just received physiotherapy.
What we think stimulation does is just increase the rate at which those cells are firing, and so speed up the learning of that new skill.
Strokes affect some 17 million people worldwide every year. Millions die from stroke, and it's the most common cause of disability in the West. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Fans have been streaming past the large impromptu memorial outside Prince's home and studio near Minneapolis. The music icon died suddenly at the age of 57, shocking and saddening music lovers worldwide. We haven't had a chance to speak since then with our pop music expert, Larry London. But now the host of Border Crossings joins us here in the studio. Thanks for being here, Larry.
Thank you, Susan. Yes, what a sad
yes,
time it is.
Yes. Prince was so big, it's kind of silly for me to even ask about his legacy, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Okay.
What's his legacy?
Well, that's yet to be determined exactly what his legacy is, but I know that his accomplishments are quite vast. When you talk about 39 albums and over 100 million record sales since he started when he was only 19 and signed to a contract in 1977, the man has collected 7 Grammys and an Oscar. And not only that, touched a lot of lives as a producer and as a songwriter. He was an icon in many respects, not only for fashion, for show business and entertainment, but he was great for what he stood for as well, because you may recall back in about 93, he stopped calling himself Prince and chose to go by an artist formerly known as Prince, and he used the love symbol, the gender for men and women combined, that was his symbol at the time, and he'd perform with a tattoo on his face, the writing that said slave, and that was his representation of his disenchantment and dissatisfaction with the music industry as a whole at that time.
Because he wanted to do his own thing.
Not only him. He just didn't like artists in general being controlled and being stifled, not only monetarily, but also creatively as well in the whole process. So that was his way of reflecting and making his statement. But in 2000, he returned to the name Prince again, which wasn't his real name, Sir Rogers Nelson. And it's interesting that his father, John, and mother, Maddie, they were in music. He grew up in a music household, a jazz family. But his dad, John, used to use the name Prince when he performed. So that's where Prince took the name.
Oh, I didn't know
Prince.
That.
Yes, and Prince was known as Skipper when he was growing
up.
It doesn't
that was
have
the same ring. Skipper
doesn't
have and
the
Prince
same,
doesn't have the same kind.
Exactly. Now, since his death last week, his record sales have increased exponentially. Millions and millions of sales and downloads, and I imagine that will continue to be the case.
One of the things that amazed me about him is he could play so many instruments, from the guitar to the drums, which is really a very different area.
Do you know how many he played?
How many?
20.
Sheesh.
He knew 20 instruments by age 12.
Wow. Wow. So, it was amazing. Yeah. And he could dance.
Yes, he could.
And he was definitely a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a style. And he helped his community.
Yes.
He had everybody into those concerts in his state there.
That's right. Paisley Park Studios is Paisley Park Home, which is the name of it. There are those people that say that it's going to be turned into a museum to honor his memory. But yes, you're right. He hosted many parties. He had rules at his house. If you wanted to come to his party, no profanity, no drugs, which is unlike, you know, what goes on in the music world, a showbiz world these days. So he, you know, he might have lived a very erotic kind of life. He was a ladies' man, but nonetheless, he wanted to be a good role model, and that he was. And a lot of people didn't realize this. He was married twice, and his wife, I believe it was his first wife, had a baby that only lived 7 days. And he had talked about, in the very few rare instances where he would speak publicly about his private life, he said that that affected him deeply.
Yes.
And it still affected him to the very end.
Well, let's listen to one of his most popular, actually the most popular song, Purple Rain. And I thank you, Larry, for stopping by.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Vietnam are deepening and broadening their ties in many areas. In a speech to university students in Vietnam, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about the culture required for entrepreneurship to flourish and how all nations and citizens share a stake in cultivating and upholding such a culture. In order for Vietnam to become a leader in technology and innovation, it must encourage an educational system that promotes critical thinking, creativity, and experimentation. Moreover, entrepreneurship and innovation thrive in a policy environment that promotes growth through transparency, the rule of law, the protection of intellectual property, and predictable regulations that enable all companies to compete on a level playing field. The task at hand is for Vietnam to consolidate its 2 decades of tremendous economic gains. An important means of doing that is through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, of which Vietnam is an original signatory. The TPP is a trade agreement that will bring 40% of the global economy together behind the highest labor, environment, and intellectual property protections in the world. Another central ingredient to Vietnam's economic success is respect for human rights. A vibrant culture of entrepreneurship, said Deputy Secretary Blinken, is almost unimaginable without a foundation of rights and freedoms upon which citizens feel able to pursue their ambitions, express their opinions, and bring their ideas to life. The U.S. urges the government of Vietnam to release all political prisoners and cease harassment, arrests, and prosecutions of journalists, bloggers, civil society activists, or students for exercising their fundamental rights. And finally, Vietnam, as part of the global economy, has a growing responsibility to participate, along with the U.S. and others, in efforts to tackle issues from international peacekeeping to wildlife trafficking to maritime security, from climate change to civil nuclear energy to global health. The United States looks forward to continuing to expand its partnership with Vietnam.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.